Welcome once again to our Transitions Multimedia Studios for the podcasting series titled Original Thinking, Remembering the Source of Our Consciousness. I'm Alan Huttner, hosting you along with my good buddy and guest, Glenn Perry, Glenn Aparicio Perry, his full name. He's the author of the book Original Thinking, A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature. That's what the series is based upon. And it's a series of four podcasts, and we are in the fourth. All to entice you, hopefully, to pick up Original Thinking, the book. That is where I would say years and years of your work, Glenn, the seed dialogues, as we talked about, 1999 to 2011, had the good fortune of hanging out with you at some of them, and the people you've brought together over the years has culminated. Much of the content of the book is quotations and references to a bunch of people who you cite as original thinkers. That was one of the notes I made in my head to say to you, thank you for bringing original thinkers to the foreground in their perspectives. And we talked about perspective in the last segment. So,
thank you for bringing that up. It's been an incredible blessing to be surrounded by visionaries.
Yeah, well, you know, you have had that good fortune in your creations, like I said. I mean, I don't know, even preceding the seed dialogues, when you had a publication based out of Albuquerque and Corrales, which was a document to draw people into new areas of learning and education, which we're going to talk about, that I felt a part of with you. Was the seed something, catalog or?
Seed.
Seed. Everything's seed.
Yeah, you could get peas and carrots or seeds of thought.
Seeds of thought.
Seeds of wisdom.
So, as we mentioned, the book is set up in four parts, and I want to go to a reading here that will lead us into part four, where Glenn says, there is good reason to believe that the outward arc of departure from our origins is coming to a close, and the inward arc of return is commencing. We are in the early stages, to be sure, but we're starting to question, starting to let go of at least some of the assumptions that have constellated the modern psyche, what Krishnamurti correctly saw as our social conditioning around time, knowledge, and accumulation, which we also have talked about. Well, we must continue to question our conditioning if we are to escape from the supposed inevitability of linear progress, a pathway that has short-term benefits for humanity but puts the whole Earth community, including ourselves, in jeopardy for the long term. We must awaken to the simple truth that our existence is bound up with that of other creatures, that all of existence has the right to be, as Moonwalker and O'Brien Levin put it, in realizing that human-centered thinking is not a sustainable path. We are returning to the essence of what we are and what we always have been, beings who are of and the interconnected earth, not transcended from our origins. Eco-theologian Thomas Berry called this direction the Great Work, a reawakening of the intimacy between human-earth relations, ushering in the ecological age. David Corton aptly adjusts this to the Great Turning, a phrase that Buddhist eco-philosopher Joanna Macy has done much to popularize. And as she says, the first principle of this life-affirming revolution is that we begin in gratitude. It makes all the difference. If we once again recognize, as indigenous peoples have for millennia, that life is a circle, a cycle, I add a spiral, therefore whole, we pray to Creator out of gratitude for all the blessings Creator provides us right now. We do not pray for something in the future to complete us. We have so much to be grateful for, beginning with the sun that gives us life, warmth, and energy, the clouds that bring the rains that nourish the trees and plants, that gives us and other animals the gift of breath that we give back to them in a sacred circle, the majestic mountains, thundering waterfalls, magical rainbows, inspiring bird songs, and the overall totality of awe-inspiring beauty and diversity on the planet. The whole world is whole and complete, and we are a part of this world, and therefore whole and complete. If we begin from wholeness, we remain in wholeness. And you bring in the Om here. Om, that is the whole. That is, this is Om. The whole. Om. I love it. So, remember this. If you do not remember anything else from this book, the origin of thinking is thanking. So I'm going to pick up with that and go right to, you want me to read the rest of this? Original thinking is thinking that begins in wholeness and gratitude for all there is. Thinking that begins in wholeness remains in wholeness. Even if it employs abstract thought for limited purposes, we are always in relationship with the whole. So we're going to get into this, the mandala of original thinking, but this leads you to your mission about education. And why don't you bridge that? We need to educate based on gratitude. We need to bring a whole new form into the world of education, and storytelling maybe has to come back in, classes in nature. I mean, how do you see that in the future?
Well, okay. before we jump into that,
yeah,
I just want to reiterate that it came to me that I actually wrote the line. Remember this if you don't remember anything else from this book. The origin of thinking is thanking. Thinking that begins in wholeness remains in wholeness. And even if you employ abstract thinking for limited purposes, we're always in relationship with the whole. These thoughts are the center hub of the book. I mean, it's absolutely true. If I wanted to write a book on original thinking and I want to investigate the origin of thinking, I investigated the etymology of both the words origin or original and thinking. And thinking does come from thanking. And, why would that be? Yeah, but I it's true. In at least seven languages that I found, it comes from the Proto-Germanic pankaz, but then in at least seven other languages, English, Dutch, Frisian, German, other languages, the act of giving thanks or thanking is related to thinking. Why would that be? And I really pondered that and then prayed on it, and I realized that it makes perfect sense. If the origin of our thought process was originally prayers. So what is a prayer? A prayer is a way most people just think of it simply as a prayer of connecting to God. But what is God? So God is some kind of force that's running through the cosmos, if we can just say simply that. And so if our type of thinking is such that we open ourselves to the force running through the universe, we're then praying. We're also thinking originally, as in the way I'm thinking of it. And that's a very powerful way to be. And if you can begin with gratitude, oh my God, what you can do. That is the way that we used to be. Before we began to fragment our consciousness and to begin to see the world as a world of scarcity. Mm-hmm. And if the world is fragmented, it's always scarce because, we've divided up the world literally. And then we compete to try to grab those resources. But if we really began from a different way, from blessing, from wholeness, from gratitude, we would see that there's enough in the world. And so that kind of beginning perspective is the key. Now, for the actual book, by the way, Alan, originally, I was going to write a book called Original Education. Mm-hmm. Because we make these plans, and then Spirit changes them for us, at least if you're open to it. So I was open, so I realized that actually it wasn't education that I was ultimately interested in, except in the really, really original meaning of education, coming from educare, which is about meaning and knowledge flowing through, so the student knows everything. Even Galileo realized this, you can't teach You can't inculcate information. It's already there. So the job of a teacher is to have it come out. And you can, again, the archaeology of words teaches you a lot. So the word teacher originally comes from learn and lore. So, and I don't mean lure, I mean lore, L-O-R-E as in a story. So what the teacher was doing was being a storyteller to evoke wisdom out that's already residing in the heart of the student, just needs to be awakened. And that's what really excites me about education, because really education begins before there ever was a school. You know, I mean, the whole limiting way we use the word today, you know, to say that we only educate in a school is really a little bit wrong, because we, of course, learn far more outside of school than inside of school. And in a way, we better forget a lot of the things we learned in school, or we'll be automatons.
Yeah.
You know, we'd get the good marks on the test, but not have any wisdom whatsoever.
You know, getting back to this think and thank relationship, mm-hmm. and we haven't used a word recently, at least that I remember, of something that profoundly affected me, and I want to bring it in here from a book. If I remember correctly, it was called The Impersonal Life, and in it was a chapter called The Ascension Attitudes. And ascension wasn't about leaving your body or going up to a spacecraft that were going to take you off the planet and save you, you know, none of that ascension, multidimensional new age stuff. Ascension was raising consciousness to wholeness, as we've been talking about. And it said you need the three ingredients, or the attitudes, are love, praise, and gratitude. And praise is kind of prayer to me. You know, it's like it's a connection with the divine, the sacred. You used the word God before, the all that is, the intelligent, the whatever. They're all words that, you know, describe something that can't even be spoken, or it's impossible to, you can touch into it, but it's vast. So gratitude, definitely, but the love is where I'm heading here before we go any further. The heart and mind as wholeness. We've talked about heart and head, or, you know, the top of the chakras matching the fourth chakra, the heart, in different traditions. The love underlies this, and I know you're going to write about it in the future, but before we take a break here and maybe go into all the aspects of original thinking, including a little bit about education and economics, speak to this love field, this vibration.
Well, it is true that I am going to write a book in the future about love, but...
Called The Book of Love, I guess.
You know, it's love is probably the principle that binds things together and can dissolve dichotomies and separations and create a unitive consciousness. You know, I didn't even use the words ever in the book Original Thinking, because I only realized it recently, but I could have subtitled it A Unitive Consciousness of Time and Place, because that's really what I was doing. Instead, I called it A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature, which on another level is what the book is about. That's what the process that we use to get to the unit of consciousness. And what a beautiful place that is to be, to re-experience origin and original as both time and place.
I think, what people mean by saying unconditional love.
It is something to do with unconditional love, indeed. Love is one of those words that has been, in some ways, overused. It becomes harder to speak about because the field is becoming less clear. But
I want to add something here.
Because please.
I said it over lunch today, and it's been showing up in the Rudy Raps that I've been doing, which is my poetic Zen Cohen-like writings about duality and love.
Wonderful.
And thank you. Thank you for saying that. I know Glenn's on the list. But I just to come up with a definition is very difficult, just like the Tao. But I've taken the four letters LOVE and thought of this acronym, Law of Vibrational Energy, or Law of Vibrational Essence. And I even go back to a book written way back in the 60s by a guy named Thaddeus Golis, The Lazy Man's Guide Enlightenment. Yes. And that's what he talked about. It's vibration. Love is expanded. Where's the end of love? It's an expansive frequency. What happens with fear?
Yes.
Contraction. It's a contracted energy. It's dense.
Yes.
So you know...
Yes.
And when you said unified field, that's what triggered it. Had you feel unified in the field?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very true. And in an odd way, when I was writing the book Original Thinking, I was expanding the definition of thinking far beyond the limited way we normally conceive it to be like you're talking about with love. Mm-hmm. So it's an expansive consciousness, which is really tantamount to love energy.
Love energy. Let's take a break here,
okay.
And we're going to come back and have a couple more segments as we cruise into this wonderful book, Original Thinking, A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature, along with our freeform journey of Glenn and I just being in love with each other, if I can say that.
Very good, I guess.
All right, we have returned. Our Transitions Multimedia studio is full of love.
Where is the love?
Glenn is singing about it. Da, 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 da. Glenn Perry, that is. Glenn Aparicio Perry. And we ended with, a statement of being in love. I love, this vibrational quality. As we've talked, the vibration has changed. Some of the conversation has been heady and intellectual, but a lot of it's been of the heart,
Well, and I have to tell your audience that, these days, a lot of my male friends will say, I love you, I love you, I love you, bro. Sometimes bro, that makes it that makes it easier for men, I suppose. But Alan Huttner is the first man that ever said that to me, and I was like, at the time I think I was slightly taken aback, but now it's normal, and what a good thing. Men need to come into more embracing of the feeling of love and recognize that we love each other. That's good.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean we're not loving women. Because we definitely love women.
It's a field of love that that we can expand or vibrate in. And I like it. There's a singer song.
All you need is love.
All you need is love. I mean, that Beatles
dun,
song.
Dun, 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 dun.
Love is all
Sorry,
there is.
Sorry, I can't stop singing.
You can sing. Were you at Lori McLean's concert for my 70th birthday?
That was my astral body only.
Oh, yeah, your astral body. Well, she wrote a song. Rising in love, and she said in the song, I don't want to fall in love. I don't want to fall in love. I want to rise in love. So, all right, we're going to...
I like falling in love.
Well, a lot of songs have been written about that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you want to say about love in economics? Because I know you have a little bit about that in the book. Love in education. I mean, is love spoken in the classroom? You probably can't hug a student. You got to. It's a hands-off thing these days.
Mm.
But maybe we need to change the attitude that had. And I know you talk about storytelling and the importance of that. And maybe the new forms of education need to be more directly experiential in nature. We need to not divide so many subjects up. But let me turn to you for a brief discussion of economics in the new economics and the new education.
Sure. I don't know how much linear time coordinates you're devoting, but that's a big topic. I'd recommend books like Charles Eisenstein's Sacred Economics, a very wonderful treatise that on page 178, he starts offering his suggestions for how to change. So it's not just a treatise about what's wrong with the world, which I agree with Charles that those kinds of books they serve some purpose, but not enough. They don't stimulate me anymore. I don't want to just hear about what's wrong. Mm-hmm. I want to actually focus on what's right, and then you're watering the seeds that need that deserve to be watered, and then they will grow. So that's actually oddly, you know, a segue to how I spoke about economics in my book. I actually wanted to reduce it to water a lot. I spoke a lot about water and why. Well, actually, all of commerce is fluid. We speak about cash flow. Economics at its base, its etymology has to do with eco, comes from the Greek oikos, and nomos has to do with management. So it's about management of the home. But what is our home? Our home planet is 70% water, and we are 70% water. So a lot, it seems to me, a lot of our thought, a lot of our communication needs to be fluid. And we need to recognize at its roots, its wet, watery roots, how economics is or can be fertilizer for good things to grow. Hopefully not just abstractions, because the discipline of economics became utterly abstract. That's my complaint with all disciplines, but economics in particular tried to model itself after physics. And was successful in a lot of ways. That's why, unfortunately, economists in some cases rule the world. I mean, they're listened to, their advice in just small towns, in counties, in cities, in states, and in the federal government. So much is done based on economic models and economic forecasts. But right now we're in a situation where I'll try to cover this succinctly, Alan, and this I throw out as a challenge to the listeners. How many of your listeners believe that unlimited economic growth is good? Even though I'm really adamantly opposed to that idea, I still almost have a reaction that I have to overcome when I hear growth is improving, because I think, you know, I have compassion for more people able to get jobs and stuff. But ultimately, you know, China had 10% growth for 35 years. What was the result of that? China doesn't have hundreds. They have thousands of rivers that have dried up. They have dead pigs that are discovered in the rivers. They have air that you've seen the pictures on TV that people can't breathe. I mean, you know, the economic growth does not work on a finite planet. You can't just grow economically forever. It just covers up and papers other failings. So we have to connect economics to its roots, which has to do with ecology. So, you know, and we have to realize the limits of that we have in the world, and we have to learn to live in a very, very different way and kind of revert back, like people like Charles Eisenstein would say, to more of a gift economy. We can do things not just for money. We don't have to make a living. We can live. And that's, now, some people may think that's not realistic. It is, actually, but I do understand why that's a hard thing to take a leap of faith on. But ultimately, we have to do what our blessing is. We have to do what our gift is. So it's not just a gift economy, it's a gift of being. We have to give our gifts to the world. And then hopefully the world will compensate us back and we'll just accept whatever level that is. That really is more important than economic growth. So that's my quick explanation of the way I treated economics in the book. Ultimately, I also was looking at economics through the lens of looking at thinking. And I want the economy to flow. I want all the rivers to be undammed. And that, by the way, can be growth if you want to just restore what was already kind of screwed up, because our dams, despite the fact that hydroelectric power is, you know, considered a good thing by some, I wouldn't consider it a good thing, because the nature of water is to flow, and we are water. That's the reason why when water isn't flowing in nature, we have cardiovascular disease. There actually is a connection.
Very, very well said. I'm on the same page with you, and I might just throw a couple of things in there about economics and measurements around finances, me being an accountant in my prior incarnations of this lifetime, and giving that up, although I still have some of those skills. You have a measurement very significant to our society called gross domestic production in this country, GDP, that measures success, and it's an inaccurate scale because there are costs in there, there are dollars in there that are things that are creating destruction, things that are affecting the environment, are affecting our health and our wellness in the wrong way. Just medical spending that is addressing people in the last year or 6 months of their life, a fortune. The environmental pollution that's coming from the industrial aspects of energy as well as weapons production and the use of them. So that's all measured in GDP.
Well, remember when you were a child, like 10 years old, and you did something and I'm not saying I was there, we all had this experience. And your 10-year-old friend, who was maybe a girl, maybe, and she said, "Gross!" Well, that's what the gross domestic product boils down to. It's gross. Yeah. It really includes everything, and it shouldn't do that. Yeah. Because, you know, we have a natural disaster like Hurricane Sandy, and the gross domestic product goes up.
Yeah, we fight continual wars.
The gross domestic product goes up. Yeah. That doesn't really measure anything. Yeah, we measure the efficiency of a quarterback in the NFL better than we measure our economy. Yeah.
Well, I did look up the Gross National Happiness Index, Bhutan, which is a small country, and it's pretty amazing what they include in their index. You know, it's based on the quality of life. And pain and suffering is not measured in the index. It's what are the qualities of life? What you know? You brought in caring into economics.
Well, pain and suffering are not measured in the U.S. systems either, and maybe they should be sometimes. You know, that's unfortunately the abstract cold numbers of economics leave out that aspect of life, and therefore we can, you know, we can get some very discompassionate leadership.
Well, look, before we take a break here and go to our final segment, 13 Qualities of Original Thinking, anything about education that you want to say? I mean, you have a big vision around that. You're talking about higher education, university education. Do we stop doing this micro cosmic breakdown of subjects into something new? We need to end the specialization and the division that we create in education. What's mm-hmm. What do we do?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the year 2000, I did have a vision come through me, which I saw then as a possible means of doing a graduate school from scratch, and it really would need to be from scratch because you couldn't really shift the way a school is designed now. There are many parts of schools that are sometimes called things like holistic studies or even like native studies, and those may be holistic within their limited sphere, but the whole school isn't. It's still each subject, each building, each budget is in competition with each other, and it's considered to be that there's a limited pie. But it seemed to me what happened is I saw a vision of an interconnected campus in which the energy of the campus went from east to south to west to north. And there were five buildings. Four were sacred rectangles, and in the center was a circular, like kiva-like building that went down into the earth. And there were pathways between the buildings, and there was an energetic that was infused. It was mainly emanating from the center, and I realized that those were the elements, that they were light and air and water and earth and spirit, spirit being in the center, that was emanating, or and it was all interconnected. And I realized that those could be the not just the elements, but they could also be the directions, and they could be in the east could be science and cosmology, in the south ecology, in the west expressive arts, and in the north healing or integral healing. In the center could be the spirit of the school. At one time, I was thinking that might be indigenous ways of knowing, because indigenous ways of knowing are fairly inclusive. But really, what I came to realize is the center ought to be original thinking. And so really what it was a vision for original thinking, more so than a graduate school. So that's what emerged is the book that's been written. But it could be implemented for a vision for a graduate institute. If we started from the center, there would be a lot of obstacles for doing that, because the entire society is set up for fragmentation and segmented education. It's hard to raise money for interdisciplinary studies, which tend to just become further specialties later on. But it's possible if you start from the ground floor, and you set it up so that you could set it up so that the teachers met as one whole, and they envisioned the whole program as one whole. And that's what I began to see, that it would be possible to have, for instance, a student taking science and cosmology, ecology, and in their first semester, and then they take the other two aspects of the mandala, expressive arts and healing, in their second semester. And they're really taking a third class each time called original thinking, which is revisioning these subjects. So they're not just learning what was out there as the inert, already knowledge. They're actually working with questions, not necessarily a Socratic way, but in a deep dialogic way, where they're actually questioning and being open. And that, it seems to me, would be part of it. I also think that, you know, they should be out in real nature, not learning from books, but be out in real nature reporting back. That would certainly be a part of it. Oral learning and being able to speak about the subjects would be at least equal to written skills, because we've reverted too much to writing. Even though I'm a writer, the fact is we have to be able to speak about it if it's coming from our heart. And if it's on a piece of paper and we don't ever hear from the student, we don't really know what they know. So I would recommend that. And I would recommend dialogue as a core pedagogy, where people are gathered and the sum total of the knowledge construction comes not just from the faculty, but from all the students, and they're all participating in the creation of knowledge. And what a beautiful world that would be.
What a great vision. And what came through was something on a t-shirt from one of my friends a long time ago, Teach Only Love. And I saw the dome in the middle, or the central gathering place, that underlying everything would be the unified field of love. That's the wholeness. You know, love is wholeness. So, and what's interesting, I know you have a picture of this in the book, mm-hmm. the drawing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you, I had a vision like this, not for the university, but for a community, mm-hmm. a similar arrangement of living, where you had your own quarters, okay, and everything you needed. Reasonable to be somewhat self-sufficient, but then these pathways to the central area where with community gathered and cooked meals and celebrated and did ceremony.
That's a very good thing. There are some schools like Schumacher College in the UK that has something like you're talking about. The gathering of cooking of meals together, what a great metaphor. It's not really a metaphor. It's actual living a chemical, you know, it's living chemistry. You cook, you know, we have the expression, you cook things up together. If more people did that, it really works. Like our mutual friend James O.D. runs workshops like that, where the people attending cook the meals together. It is a beautiful way to connect consciousness. And, you know, I once heard one of the strangest things I've ever heard is that the schools that are associated with the most Nobel laureates have the best eating facility because the people linger at the dining hall and they intermix ideas. And because, unfortunately, you know, the subjects are so segmented that they're stuck that way. But if they eat together, all of a sudden they can cook up new visions, which are truly transdisciplinary. That's some good cooking, the good home cooking I'd like to eat.
Well, that guy right back up there, Neem Karoli Baba, who is a teacher, guru, saint to many who traveled to India, he said, love, serve and remember and feed the world. That was the message. Feed the world, literally. But we're talking about education as a form of food, too. So we're going to come back.
That's food for thought.
Food for thought. We're going to come back and we're going to briefly wrap this all up with the 13 qualities of original thinking that Glenn has so aptly put into a mandala in the book, Original Thinking. Alan Hutter here with Glenn Perry, Glenn Aparicio Perry, a longtime friend, a chance to really hang out in this podcasting series that we've named Original Thinking, Remembering the Source of Our Consciousness, which is inspired by Glenn's book that we've kind of coursed through in pieces and conversation in a lot of free form, Original Thinking, A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature. And towards the end of the book, there's a question. Well, actually, it is a quality mandala. It's a circle, because we've been talking about circles throughout this, circles and cycles. And Glenn has kind of identified 13 qualities of original thinking. I think they're really fun and accurate, and I'd like to go through them with you. And I know you wanted to also say that there could be more than 13, that this is
There could be more or less. I mean, these are not to be understood in some formulaic way. These are qualities or aspects that emerge through the whole book. So I think I mentioned in the first podcast that the book was written in this way where I really trusted in spirit and it unfolded. So really, I was trying to match my message with my actual writing. So if I'm saying that we should be connecting with the unfolding rhythms of nature, that's the way I wanted to write the book, too. Otherwise, it would be a force, trying to force some kind of thing back in. So these qualities, I didn't say in the beginning, like most books would do these days, would say, these are the 13 qualities, and then explain them during the book. Instead, they come near the end, only after they've already emerged in the book, and I'm kind of, showing it back to the reader. But they're not to be understood in any limited way. It's impossible to define original thinking. These are just qualities or aspects of it that will help give a little bit fuller explanation. So that's how the listener should receive it now.
Okay, great. And there's a sentence here that says, in truth, original thinking is more of a process than a thing. I like that. Mm-hmm. And so the thing that's in front of me, which is this representation, kind of looks like a clock in some ways. There's 12 different...
I didn't even think about that.
It's got 12 segments in it.
Yeah, but there's 13 qualities because one segment has two emerging from it.
Thankful.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, so original thinking is thankful. I mean, we've had this discussion on a variety of occasions during our podcast series. Anything you want to add about that?
Well, sure. I mean, everything... thinking comes from thanking. I have no problem repeating that. That's the first quality. It feels like the emergent first quality of original thinking is thanking. So my wife said this beautiful thing to me when she heard that I was saying original thinking is thinking coming from thanking. She says, it's important then to thank before you think. So I like to say thank before you think before you speak, and think three times before you post on Facebook.
Good. Okay, original thinking emerges out of wholeness. Comes from wholeness. Speak to that.
Well, that's highly related to thinking coming from thanking, thinking coming from blessing, thinking coming from wholeness. So if it's original, it's whole, just like dreams come in whole, visions come in whole. Later on, we segment and break up the whole for limited purposes, and that's okay. But original thinking emerges out of wholeness.
Original thinking comes from particular places or origins, and we may have touched on this, but this is a very important one here.
Yeah, that's absolutely important. So there's a dual, what I'm seeking to do is a unit of consciousness of time and place. So we looked at the origin of thinking as thanking, but also the origin of original is place. Rather than time. Time was the overlay that the West laid upon place, and then hence we looked for the beginning of time, and we're actually addicted to the idea that there has to be a beginning, middle, and end to everything. But really, original thinking comes from the land, it emerges from the land, it comes from particular places. There are some cultures and some peoples that when they have a thought, they look around to see where that thought came from. Did it come from that frog? Did it come from that stone? Did it come from that tree? It comes from somewhere, and then they can make a deeper connection with it. Now, you don't necessarily have to believe that, although I do mostly believe that. But it's coming from outside of you, through you. That's why we say a thought. We still have the expression, a thought came to me. And the reason is because that's really true. Your brain is just a three-dimensional sensor, or your heart, or your gut, wherever you're receiving that thought. But the thought has a life of its own, and it moves, and it comes to you, and it comes to you from a particular place. It comes to you differently in different places. So really briefly, when I'm in Taos, New Mexico, and I know your show is podcast a lot of places, so if you don't know Taos, it's a very famous place, a small village, a place where great artists have lived. And I think one of the reason why I like to go to Taos to write is because of the land is it does a number of things. There's mountains going up. There's also a gorge where that cuts deep into Mother Earth, more than a mile down, where the Rio Grande runs, and also in one place the Red River, which I spoke about earlier, as a confluence, but it also stretches for a long way horizontally. So your consciousness is stretched horizontally, vertically, and then downward vertically, up, down, and out. And that's a beautiful thing. So that's why I feel very expansive in Taos.
Like that. I know that confluence of the Red River and the Rio Grande. I've walked down that point.
I did too.
It's just incredible. Yeah.
It is incredible.
Well, original thinking is not new or old, but both.
Right.
That. Yeah.
That's very important. So we tend to use the word original as in this progressive way that it's something new that's never been said before or done before. But really, that's kind of ridiculous because there really is nothing new under the sun. So original thinking is something that's later on, I think I use the aspect wise, because it's timeless and wisdom is timeless. So it's neither new or old, both. It's something that can cross the dimensions of time in the way we think of time.
Original thinking is in sync with the rhythms and cycles of nature.
Absolutely. So there's an appropriate time to think and act in certain ways. And really, all of thought operates in a cycle, kind of a hydrological cycle. There's a part of the book where I talk about paradigms itself as being of water, you know, because they're like a hydrological cycle. Thoughts coalesce into you know, a drop into a pool, into the river, into the ocean, evaporating into the atmosphere and then coming back down to Earth. And there's even a relationship between thought that goes, we use mainstream thought and underground thought. Well, because there's a relationship, and some thoughts have to go underground, but they do emerge again.
That's a good connecting point to original thinking that's out of the box or out of the box thinking. And I'm going to read this line. I loved it. It is holistic, meta-paradigmatic, and timeless, connecting old and new and original and creative combinations of thought.
That sounds good. Who wrote that?
Out of the box. Get out of the box. Original thinking looks for the patterns that connect.
Ah, yes. Well, one of our modern philosophers and a really super intelligent being was Gregory Bateson. Gregory Bateson began as an anthropologist. He was working and married to Margaret Mead, another famous anthropologist. When they first started their career, they really were like other anthropologists. They kept a distance from the village, and they realized very quickly, though, that didn't work. They needed to be part of what was happening in the village. And then Bateson and Mead, to some extent, also helped formulate the beginnings of what later became known as participatory action research, and this idea of putting yourself in the village, you know. And that's happened so much now that, you know, Vine Deloria Jr. joked about, you know, that the average indigenous family had a mother, a father, three children, a grandmother, a grandfather, and an anthropologist. You know, but still, the thing is, Bateson went way beyond the boundaries of anthropology, though. He began to realize that all things are interconnected, and he became one of the first and best-known transdisciplinary thinkers. And the famous saying that he said was, what is the pattern that connects?
Yeah.
And it's very true. It's what you need to look for.
Yeah, yeah. That's getting back to that love word again. You know, love is about connectivity. Love is.
Your listeners know that Alan brings things back to love, and that's a beautiful idea, and it's true. Love is the connector. Love dissolves the dichotomies. I see that's missing there. I don't have that original thinking is love. See, if you had co-authored the book, that would definitely be in there.
I would want it in there. All right.
Yeah, I have to do it second edition.
Original thinking embraces paradox and change. And I love that, you know, because there's a lot of weird stuff going on in the world, very paradoxical things, and rapid change. So, I mean, that's how we named the radio show, Transitions Radio Magazine. We picked a word that embraced reality that is in constant change. So I'm glad.
Well, you know, here's the way I look at it. You know, paradox is a weird word, but the world is in flux and change, and the things that we consider opposites, like the Democratic and Republican Party or something, are not opposites. They're dance partners, and they're moving and changing and interacting based on what the other dance partner does. That's so if we're going to see clearly, we have to see not through the paradox to a third point. It's not about creating a synthesis. It's about, like we spoke about before, allowing the differences to be, mm-hmm. and understanding that they are not polar opposites. They are complements. That just like men and women, summer and winter, these are complements. They each complete the other. And so an original thinker, if you want to use that phrase, or to think originally, you have to accept those as complements, and it's not about opposition.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love the kind of metaphor of energy, that you need two poles, you know, plus and minus, to create current. You know, it's the way it works.
And patience. I mean, that's another aspect or quality of original thing I could have put in there, because, you know, Grandfather Leon used to counsel me that given enough time, a negative becomes a positive, and a positive becomes a negative. So, you know.
Original thinking includes feeling.
Yeah.
That's
there I could have put love. Yeah, original include. We'll just have to strike that. Original.
Is it too late? Can you get to the publisher?
Probably too late. It's all the feelings on the spectrum, because thought is a continuum. So, from your gut instincts to your heartfelt loving emotions, to your intuitions, to your sacred contemplations, and to rational, logical thinking, it's all there. But feeling is part of thinking, and you know it's an odd thing, in my opinion, to separate that, to say, I think, no, and let me say, no, I don't think, I feel, or I know, or I believe, or I, you know, all these different ways of expressing are expressing something that's flowing over you.
Yeah.
Why do we want to make a distinction? They're all part of the same field.
Yeah, yeah, and that leads to this 10th item here on the list. Original thinking is a form of participatory consciousness.
Mm.
And we move consciousness, we move molecules, we move atoms through us. Creator source is a word used for defining the all that is, or great mystery. But we're co-creating. We are that. We're co-creating with Creator.
Well, that's not the way I'm using it.
Oh, okay.
I'm not saying that's not true, but that may be true on a certain level. But in this case, what I'm talking about in participatory consciousness is also with, it is with Creator, it is with nature, but it's also just with other people, other minds. So we're creating a field of knowing, a field of thought, like we do in a dialogue circle. That's what I meant, like a field of thought that you and I are doing right now. And actually, since we're feeling into the future, because we're actually taping this, it's not even going to air in the future, but I am, and I'm sure you are, feeling what is in the field of your future listener. It's very possible to do it. So that's what we're trying to react to.
Yeah.
And isn't that an interesting phenomenon?
It very. I have arguments with a couple of friends about taping an event on a television, like particularly a football game. And they think by watching it live, they can influence the outcome. And I say, well, maybe, but, you know, when I'm watching it taped, it still exists in the all that is field. So maybe that can change too. Who knows? You know, I know it's kind of.
Well, that's very odd that you bring that up. Now, if I tape a game, I always try to get back to real time before the end. Because otherwise, I think I'll know the outcome just by the field, and it will no longer be theater.
All right, well.
Just so you know.
Original thinking is beautiful.
Oh, yes. And that's, remember we spoke about how rational originally comes from ratio, which has to do with the relationship between things. And if that relationship is in divine proportion, or the right proportion, or what's called the, you know, the golden mean, then things are beautiful.
Yeah.
So thought can be beautiful. And that's really the kind of thought we want. Elegant, beautiful, harmonious thought.
Yeah, because thought is creative.
Yeah.
You got a choice. Why not think beauty, the beauty way?
Yes, the beauty way. Well said.
Original thinking is radical.
Radical in the original sense of the word radical, which means going to the roots. You know, just like when, if you were trying to learn Chinese, you know, they say there were Chinese radicals. Those are the roots of the words.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, thinking like a tree, you know, being radical in the winter, getting in rhythm with how the trees are spreading their roots deep into the earth. That's my favorite time to write. That's my favorite time to contemplate. That's my favorite time to be alone, actually. I want to be, when I say alone, I mean not with in too many social situations.
Would you connect radical with out of the box in any way? Because, you know, I think, you know, some of the mainstream thoughts about radical is, you know,
Radical is one of those words that has been shifted.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about the original meaning of radical, which means going to the roots, which means trying to expose. And if you think about it, you can see how the meaning shifted. Because if you get to the root of something, that just isn't done very often. So if you do that, they're going to call that that's radical, and then it becomes associated with its new meaning, which means extreme.
Yeah.
So, but it's not really extreme as in a polarized way.
Yeah.
But that's unfortunately the way it's become associated. So
okay, good.
And we just say either radical right or radical left.
Okay, good. And then lastly, 13, original thinking is wise. Gets us back to that previous conversation we had about wisdom.
Yeah. That one is so difficult to explain that I didn't, when I was listing the qualities of original thinking, I deferred that to later on in the book. You can even read it if you want, where I spoke about what is wisdom. But I could also, see what comes through now.
Yeah, just summarize it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, to me, knowledge and the accumulation of knowledge has nothing to do with wisdom and often prohibits wisdom. Mm-hmm. So when I was trying to envision what is wisdom, first, wisdom is timeless because it applies, it's always appropriate. It never goes out of season. It does go underground often. But if there's an opportunity for wisdom to be enacted, it's always a good thing, because wisdom seems to account for whatever the contemporary experience is. So I mostly associate wisdom with nature. If I try to think about wisdom with people and in people, I would think about people who are in tune with the rhythms of nature and are living their life in a wise way. It's the quality of how they live their life that makes them wise. It doesn't have to do with what information they've stored. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that they don't have an intellect. They do. But because they're living in tune with wisdom, they're very present, and they're able to say what is appropriate at the present moment. They're able to let spirit move through them to say what needs to be said at the present moment. They're able to be present with the people that need their attention. They're not in stress. They're in the flow. And that's why people gravitate toward wise people. That's why they want to be around them, because they're actually emitting a kind of a glow, which is why some, gurus and stuff even have, practices of darshan, where it's just to be in the presence of a wise one is can be healing in itself, even if you never have a conversation or ask a question like these cartoons about, climbing a mountain and asking a question.
Wisdom is born of real experience, you say here.
Uh-huh.
And I like that. Uh-huh. There's the experience.
You can read part of it if you want. Yeah, yeah. I'll probably sit.
Well, I'm going to read this here. The people I consider wise are very present in the moment and have undoubtedly been so for some time. They become wise through an attitude of open engagement. It is not the accumulation of life experience that makes them wise, but the way they have experienced life. They know things in a way that many of us do not simply know, because they trust in their intuition. They may have surprisingly analytical minds when needed, but they do not rely solely upon rational thought. They allow for the mysterious to augment their moment-to-moment awareness, and it's this quality that makes them wise. A wise person has wisdom vibrating through every aspect of their being. You can feel it just from being in their presence. Very well said.
Thank you.
And I've been enjoying the wisdom that's come through us in our dialogue in this podcasting series. So I thank you.
And me as well. Thank you very much. All love to you. Love to your listeners.
Yeah. All love. Love is all.
Love is all you need.
All right.